Made possible with support from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga with specialty classes for men's flexibility, women's health, seniors, and plus size. New classes start June 1st. Information available at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com. Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing this program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about strategic intelligence, and our guest will be Locke Johnson. He is Regents Professor of Political Science at University of Georgia. Hour number two, we will talk about the U.S., Mexico, and NAFTA, and our guest will be David Bacon. He is Associate Editor at Pacific News Service. He's also regular contributor to many publications, including The Nation and LA Weekly, others. He's the author of a book that we'll talk about. It's titled The Children of NAFTA, the subtitle Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week and always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about America's prisons. And our guest for the program is a journalist who has been written about conditions in jails and prisons for quite a long time. His name is Alan Elsner, and he works for the Reuters news agency. Currently, he is their national correspondent. He's the author of a book that's titled Gates of Injustice, The Crisis in America's Prisons, and it's published by Prentice Hall. It's out now and in bookstores if you'd like to take a look at it. As we talk this morning with our guest, comments and questions are certainly welcome. The only thing that we ask of people calling in is that they are brief. We just ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many people as possible. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. Just let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. He has been a journalist now for 25 years and has held a number of jobs with news agency, with Reuters. He is now their national correspondent and has covered the terrorist attacks of 9/11, also terrorism issues. Before that, he was the chief political correspondent and headed Reuters teams that covered the 96 and 2000 presidential elections. He also served before that as the State Department correspondent and also has been correspondent in both London and Jerusalem. And he is joining us by telephone. Mr. Elsner, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
I almost hesitate to start out by making a reference to Abu Ghraib, but I will, just because you have made a connection, and I know other people who are interested in prisons in this country and corrections issues have made the connection too. And basically, here's what they have said. They have said that we see the fact that there is so much. So many people are so upset by the images that we have seen and by the treatment of the Iraqi prisoners of war. At the same time, people will argue that things not unlike this have gone on in American prisons and have gotten some coverage, and yet Americans don't seem to be quite so concerned, and certainly the American government doesn't seem to be quite so concerned about what happens to the inmates of America's prisons. Certainly there's not as much concern has been voiced about that as has been voiced about Abu Ghraib.
Well, you're absolutely right. I wouldn't make a complete parallel, although there are similarities, but I'm not aware of naked bodies being piled up in a kind of human pyramid in the U.S. prisons. But I am aware of cases in which people have been made to strip naked, have been sexually abused, have been intimidated with dogs. And, you know, even more serious than that is the daily abuse that goes on in prisons, the rape, which is endemic in our prison systems, the abuse of women, which is a major problem, the abuse of the mentally ill, another major problem, 300,000 mentally ill people in our prison system, and also the neglect that goes on, the neglect of people's health conditions, the spread of infectious diseases within prisons and then from prison to the community. So I do think that there are parallels, and I do ask myself, where is the outrage?
How many people now are in prison in the United States?
It's about 2.2 million people, and that figure, astounding though it is, it's a fourfold increase over the last 25 years. And, of course, we have more prisoners in this country than in any other nation in the world. We have 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners. And there are about 10 million people who are booked into our jail system every year and cycle through the jail system. There are about 600,000, more or less, on any given day, but many, many more who pass through it.
And one of the statistics that you cite that I think perhaps will surprise some people is that, particularly in recent years, apparently, there has been a very significant increase in the number of women in prison.
That's right. Women are now the fastest growing sector of the prison population. Still relatively small compared to the male population, but growing fast. And what you have to say about this is that the vast majority of them are there for nonviolent crimes. Very often it's drugs possession. And so they are victims of the so-called war on drugs, in which we have incarcerated hundreds of thousands of people for possessing drugs, for basically victimless crimes, people who are harming themselves by using substances, but not harming other people in the same way as, for instance, somebody who assaults somebody or robs them or kills them or rapes them. And strikingly, the average sentence handing down by the courts for drugs possession is more than double what you would get for assault. So, you know, my book is trying to point out that this just makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, no doubt part of the reason for the increase, not just in the number of women in prison, but the total number of people in prison, part of that does, I'm sure, have to do with this thing that we call the war on drugs. How much of that also has to do with the fact that in many places, sentencing discretion has been taken away from judges?
Well, I think that's a major part of it. The mandatory sentencing that has come in has meant that people are sent away for inordinate lengths of time often, and it's usually to do with drugs. So the two are connected. We started the war on drugs probably in the early 70s, and so we've been doing it now for almost 25 years. And according to all the surveys I've seen, just as many people use drugs now as then. We're spending $20 billion a year on the war on drugs. We're spending $57 billion on our prison system. So if you add those two together, that's a pretty hefty chunk of money.
Something else, and you did touch on it, that also is, I think, a very striking number, is the number of people in prison who are seriously mentally ill. And with the book comes this line with the material that comes in the book, that in fact the three largest mental institutions in the world are the L.A. County Jail, Rikers Island in New York, and Cook County Jail in Chicago.
Yeah, that is an astounding figure. I don't think many Americans know that. I was astounded when I was told it, and I did check it out. But about 4,000 people on any given night in the L.A. County jail system who are seriously mentally ill, and the system is spending about $10 million a year on drugs for them. Now, what's happened here is that we have closed down most of the state mental hospitals and institutions that used to provide beds for these people. They were thrown out onto the streets. Many of them are addicted to substances, and of course they cycle through the jail and prison system. You know, very often they go in, they're in a kind of revolving door. They'll go in for 20 days, and then they'll go back to the streets, and then they'll go in again, and they'll go back to the streets again, and maybe they'll pay a visit to the hospital emergency room somewhere along the line. And what I'm trying to argue in Gates of Injustice is not only is this a cruel and neglectful way for society to deal with these people, but it's also an incredibly costly way to deal with them. You couldn't really devise a less efficient and more expensive way to deal with this very unfortunate segment of our society.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose you would say the same for people who have substance abuse problems and a lot of the other kinds of problems that end up either landing people in jail or are an important coexisting issue.
Well, yes, I would, because I think that if you look at other countries, they deal with substance abuse in a completely different way. There are many things that you can do. You can have treatment. You can have education. If you want to punish people, you can punish them by sending them to do community service or probation or warning or house arrest, but just not prison, because you know there are many harmful substances that people use in our society. Cigarettes is a harmful substance. Alcohol, when used to excess, is a harmful substance. And these are people who harm themselves, but we don't imprison them for it. And so to send somebody away for 10 or 15 years for possession of a few grams of marijuana, to me, makes no sense whatsoever. What it does is it destroys communities because the onus has fallen particularly on our inner cities and on our minorities. It takes parents away from their children, and that's especially the case with women. 80% of the women in our prison system are mothers. And so the children end up with fractured families in fractured communities. They tend to go to the streets, they join gangs, and there you have the next generation of our prison and jail inhabitants growing up.
How many prisons, or what percentage of prisons can you say, are providing something in the way of treatment for people who come to prison with drug or alcohol problems?
Well, according to a study that I quote from the federal government, only about 10% of the people who need drug treatment get it in the prison system. What is true, however, is that if you want to continue your addiction in the prison system, that is very much available to you, because any drug that you name is available in the prison system. They are smuggled in by visitors or in packages, or, and this is probably the most damaging way that they get in, by the small minority of corrections officers who decide to augment their salaries by selling drugs to the inmates. And it's a serious problem. The federal government looked at this in the Federal Bureau of Prisons a few years ago, and they found that actually every single facility that they looked at had drugs in it. And in fact, the higher the security classification of a facility, the more drugs that there were.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll get them into the conversation, and for everyone else, and particularly if you've just tuned in, I want to reintroduce our guest. Alan Elsner is national correspondent for Reuters News Agency, and as a reporter has covered a lot of different stories, both national and international. He's also written a lot about conditions in jails and prisons and has a book on that subject. It's titled Gates of Injustice, The Crisis in America's Prisons. Questions here on the program are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And I believe that we'll start with the caller in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. The president last night said that he's going to wipe Abu Ghraib off the face of the earth. And I'm just wondering how we're going to mark, or how we're going to wipe off the marks on men's and women's souls. But I'm not speaking about sin. I mean more wipe off the what's engraved on their psyches, those that participated in these tortures. And I'm wondering how many torturers and abusers will make their way back into the prison system in the U.S., either as guards or inmates, given that the Veterans Administration's not really supporting veterans anymore and is cutting a lot of mental health services. Do you think some of the participants, the U.S. soldiers and civilian contractors, might end up with post-traumatic stress syndrome and either become drug addicts or violent abusers of other people, you know, wives, children, criminals, etc.?
Well, I think this is a little off the subject of what my book is about, but there is one point on which I think is very important, and that is that the trauma that people suffer inside the prison system does come back to haunt the rest of society. Congressman Frank Wolf, a Republican from Virginia, made this point. He was a sponsor of something called the Rape Prevention Act, which was signed by President Bush last year and which seeks to find ways to combat prison rape. And he said the best way of creating a sociopath is to subject him to this kind of abuse, and it's something that never leaves you. So it's very true to say that, you know, in this country over the last 25 years, we really had an attitude of lock them up and throw away the key, and whatever happens to them, in some sense, they got it coming to them. And I think that that's wrong, because 95% of the inmates of our prison system are going to get out one day, and they're going to come back to their communities, and whatever they suffered while they were inside, that's going to come back to the communities with them.
What is the current recidivism rate?
It's about two-thirds. Within 3 years, about two-thirds are back. And, you know, obviously that's a sign of a failing system.
Let's go to Belgium nearby, line number four. Hello.
Good morning. It's obvious that there's a problem with the drug laws if a high percentage of the people in prison are in jail for that one particular cause. But there's also an aspect of it that seems to be missing in your discussion, and that is the profitability in it. Not only do the drug dealers make money off the drugs, but then the law enforcement makes money off of it. In other words, you need more officers, you need more guns, you need more cars, you need more jails, you need more jailers. It becomes an industry in itself.
I cover this in Gates of Injustice. There's a chapter on the financial aspects of the prison system, and you're quite right. We have about 2 million people working in corrections, which is actually more than the combined workforce of the three largest corporate employers in the United States. That's GM, Ford, and Walmart. And there are many communities that have become completely dependent on prisons for their employment. I quote the case of Fremont County in Colorado, where there are 13 prisons in one small county, 9 state and 4 federal. And the number one employer is the State Department of Corrections, and number two is the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And there are these prison towns, hundreds of them actually, that have sprung up over across the length and breadth of this country. It's an astounding statistic that I'm going to give you here, but between 1985 and 1995, this country was opening a new prison at an average rate of 1 a week.
Yes, that is frightening. Also, the aspect that judges have jobs for this. It goes on and on, just like you say, sir. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to another caller. The next will be someone in Indiana, and this would be line number 2. Hello.
Hello, yeah. I did 8 years, basically the whole decade of the 70s, for drug charge. I don't know if you talk about this in the book, but the other things you've talked about anecdotally I know about firsthand. One thing that surprised me, I became a jailhouse lawyer. I was educated. And a number of people, just from the small group of people I ran across to do suits for them and stuff up through the federal system, I got 2 guys out because they're in illegally. And all it took was, one page of piece of paper and say, refer to, such and such a law in this state, refer to such and such a law in the federal thing. And next thing you know, these guys were offered immediate parole. I just don't know if you touched upon that sort of thing in your book, but when those sort of things come down, you have to start questioning, the home base, the prosecutor, the cops, and all that, when they actually send somebody away with an illegal sentence, which that really disturbed me when I was inside, and I did my best to get a few guys out. Thank you.
I think it's impossible to quantify how many people are wrongly in prison, but if you look at the death penalty, and especially in Illinois, you see that mistakes certainly do happen. Your caller makes an interesting point. He described himself as a jailhouse lawyer, and I think that since he was in prison in the 70s, the authorities have really cracked down on so-called jailhouse lawyers. They really don't like them. They've cut down on access to...
Yeah, they didn't like you at the beginning of the
Yeah. They've cut down on access to law books and and in some cases, jailhouse lawyers actually face abuse. There are cases of so-called jailhouse lawyers being stuck in a cell with a known rapist to kind of straighten them out.
Yeah.
So, it's a very abusive kind of system where the authorities very often resent any kind of initiative, any kind of control on the part of the inmates, and will victimize them for it.
Yeah, well, I sort of, if you can talk in those terms, I sort of lived in the golden age of the federal and state laws for the prison system, because that's when we had a Supreme Court that was doing things in terms of civil rights and stuff. I know most of that has been taken aback by the Rehnquist group. I've lost a lot of connections, because some of those things aren't even reported anymore. But therefore, in the while in the early 80s, some of the things were set back, restrained in some order and stuff like that. So I knew that there were a lot of people that weren't going to get any sort of, legal help simply because the things they did to change the law. And as you say, I found myself moved 13 times from one unit to another, and I had a buddy. We started out at the Walls, and he moved, he was usually at some places less than 4 hours, because he carried his books with him. He had 13 boxes of the federal regulations with him, and he just was bopped from one place to another. And I always thought it was amazing how well the paperwork went through so damn fast that, you know, in 4 hours he'd be sent to another unit, where it might take you, a year and a half to get to another unit closer to your home. I get off. I could talk for days about this sort of thing. You know, it's just part of my past now. But it's certainly given me a very interesting perception into the law in our country as a whole.
Well, thanks for the
call.
Thanks
a lot.
Well, if you want to kind of get back to me, I don't know if the caller can still hear me, and read the book and wants to send me some email, my web address, my email access is on the back cover of the book. It's alanelsner.com. Alan, A-L-A-N, Elsner, E-L-S-N-E-R, .com, and if anyone wants to email me, they can do so.
All right.
I get a lot of interesting stories, actually, through the email. Got one the other day from a guy. This is interesting because it kind of chimes in with his caller, being a jailhouse lawyer. This particular individual was well-educated. When he got to prison, the authorities made him take a GED. He said, I don't need a GED. I have a college degree. They said, you got to take the GED. And it turns out that when he was taking it, half of the cell block was in there taking it with him and copying down his answers. And they use this as a way of displaying their success in getting people through the GED. It was a complete fraud.
Let's go to another caller. This would be Urbana, and it's line 3.
Yes, hi. Yes. I remember in the first Clinton administration, the framing and the passing of the Three Strikes, You're Outlaw, which, was so outrageous then and continues to be, makes you wonder what they were smoking. I'm wondering if you could address the Three Strikes, You're Out policy, and has there been any kind of a backlash toward it in an institutional way? Thank you.
Interestingly, the Supreme Court last year found that Three Strikes was constitutional, but Justice Kennedy, who was one of the 5 votes that voted for that, it went 5-4, then made a speech to the American Bar Association last summer in which he said we shouldn't confuse the fact that a law is constitutional with the fact that it's a just law. He was basically saying the law is constitutional, but it's unjust. It's unjust to send people away for 25 to 50 years for stealing pairs of jeans or for stealing videos, which were the 2 instances that came to the Supreme Court. The backlash, I think, is happening because the costs of the system are just out of control. 10% of the prison population now is serving life, which is almost doubled in the last 10 years, and it's largely as a result of 3 strikes and similar things. And if we're going to keep people in prison for life, they're going to grow old and eventually going to die in prison, so we're going to have to set up geriatric wards for them, which some prison systems are doing. We're going to set up hospices for them. I visited a hospice in Angola prison in Louisiana, and they're going to get every kind of illness that the rest of us get in old age. They're going to get cancer, Alzheimer's. I met a guy in Angola who was 94 years old and had Alzheimer's and no longer remembered why he was there in the first place. And, of course, treating these people in a prison is about the most costly way that you could devise to do it, because prisons are not hospitals. They're not set up for this.
Another caller here. Next would be in Chicago, line 1. Hello.
Hello. Their stories are heartbreaking, but I wondered about the socioeconomic aspects of it. I know that the prison guards have been so powerful in California. I believe they have a political lobby, and they're a major force in determining the politics. And I know in a lot of these states where they have, or a lot of these small towns where they have encouraged the building of prisons, it almost seems as if it's a job creation program, and it's a job creation program at the lowest level because the people who staff the prisons usually don't need much more than a high school education or if that. And it almost seems as if we've made these prisons a substitute for improving our school systems, for creating jobs, and also for just creating a quality of life for our citizens.
I couldn't agree with more with what you said. First of all, on the point of the California Prison Guards Union, the CCPOA, California Correctional and Peace Officers Association, most California politicians will tell you that is the most powerful PAC in the state. They actually had Governor Gray Davis pretty firmly in their pockets. And when he was trying to cut the budget, he cut everything except corrections. The present governor is not indebted to them, so we'll see if he dares take them on.
but they're incredibly powerful in smaller county elections for things like judgeships, district attorneys, those kind of posts. Now, on the point of prisons going to depressed areas, again, you are completely correct. If you look at where the new prisons have been sited, many of them have gone to places like Appalachia, where the coal mining industry collapsed, or in Northern California, where the forestry industry collapsed. And they are indeed alternative forms of employment for these communities, which become completely dependent on them.
What that goes, I guess, to my last question is, I think it would be very difficult for change, because at the grassroots level, you see people who believe that their future is dependent on these other people's incarceration.
Well, I think that's a grave danger. Indeed, I think that, that shrinking the prison system will run into resistance from a whole bunch of entrenched lobbies. But what I'm concerned with now is not actually shrinking the system, but stopping its growth, because it's just continuing to grow and grow and grow. We've had 10 years of falling crime rates, and yet the prison system continues to grow. That's not logical. If we have falling crime rates, less crime, less arrests, less people should be going to prison. That hasn't happened. In fact, more and more. And so we're in a cycle of self-sustained growth right now. We have two-thirds recidivism, as I mentioned before, and we have gangs becoming an even more serious problem by the year, by the day, in our inner cities. And I think all these things are very much connected. If we don't stop the madness, you know, when I wrote my book, I cited a figure of the cost of the prison system at $49 billion. And just earlier this month, about 2.5 weeks ago, the Justice Department updated that figure to $57 billion. That's a growth of $8 billion in the space of 2 years. Incredible growth. I mean, how can we afford this? You know, we're spending, just to give you a basis of comparison, $42 billion on the Federal Department of Education. So we're spending much more on prisons than we are on education at the federal level.
If I could allow just one more question.
Sure.
It seems like it's going into a cycle, because we are losing more and more jobs, and more areas are becoming depressed as the manufacturing jobs move out. And these people are at the exact same educational level. Most of them do not have college. And so it would seem that to create another prison to make up for the corporation that's moved out of town.
You know, in my book, I cite a case of Correction Corporation of America actually built a prison in Georgia on spec. It's like, you know, building some townhouses, and you assume people are going to come and buy them. So you build a prison, build it, and they will come. You know, nobody asked them to build this prison. The state didn't ask them to build it. The federal government didn't ask them. They just built it on the supposition that sooner or later it would get filled. It did stand empty for about a year, and then, sure enough, the federal government came along with a contract because it needed more beds to house immigrants and asylum seekers, and as a fallout from 9/11, so that strategy by Correction Corporation paid off very handsomely for them.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Again, let me introduce our guest. The guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Alan Elsner. He is national correspondent for the Reuters News Service and has been since 2001. He covered the 9/11 attacks, the war on terrorism. He's done a lot of other things, including serving as the chief political correspondent, heading the teams that covered the 96 and 2000 presidential elections. Before that, he was the State Department correspondent and, among other stories, covered the end of the Cold War. He's also been correspondent in London and Jerusalem and has written a lot about this issue that we're talking about this morning, that is, conditions in jails and prisons. His book is Gates of Injustice, The Crisis in America's Prisons. Prentice Hall is the publisher. It is out now in bookstores if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to take a moment here. We've been talking about the problems of the prisons, how big they are, the increase in the population, how much it's costing, how bad conditions are. And so if we've been talking about that for about a half an hour now, let me ask you, because you also do address it in the book, if you can talk a little bit about how you think that the system as it is could be changed, should be changed.
Yeah, I think that I have a whole bunch of concrete suggestions. So the first one is we've got to stop the war on drugs. We've alluded to that. We've got to stop incarcerating people who are harming themselves, perhaps, but not harming other people, and prison is not the right place for them. The second one is this question of mandatory sentences, and we've got to kind of dismantle that system somehow. It's going to be tough because politicians all like to say that they're tough on crime and all like to do everything that they can to avoid being labeled as soft on crime. I think that the strategy is to say that this is bankrupting us. It's not a question of hard on crime or soft on crime. It's a question of fiscal sanity and what serves our society best. The third major suggestion is we've got to do something about the mentally ill. The prison is just not the place to treat them. Now, some of them have committed serious crimes and probably need to be incarcerated. But there are others who are just cycling through the system in this revolving door, coming back again and again and again. And when they're released is the time to grab them and help them. I highlight a pilot program in Rochester, New York, where they get people as they were released from jail. These are mentally ill people, and they find them some kind of assisted living situation where there's somebody on hand that can help them with their daily needs and keep them on their meds, and they keep them in programs. And the cost savings of this are just enormous. You know, this country had a pact when we closed down the mental hospitals. At the same time, we were supposed to open a network of clinics in the community to serve these people. Those clinics never got opened. We let down the mentally ill. We betrayed them. And we really have to go back, retrace our footsteps, and redress that wrong.
Hmm. Let's talk with some other folks here. Urbana, next, line two.
Hello. Nice. I was going to just see what you would have to say about the issue of rehabilitation. Haven't really discussed it much yet. Specifically, in terms of, I tend to cringe when I hear about sort of faith-based programs, but my father has always been a very religious guy, and he came out here from England over Christmas to Urbana, and he became very interested in a number of prisons in this area. He went to visit one in Iowa, which had some kind of program where it's kind of essentially like a religious-based sort of rehabilitation program for offenders, and he was very impressed by the very low recidivism rates and stuff like that.
You're probably referring to Chuck Colson and his prison fellowship.
That sounds very familiar. Yeah,
right. And they have a prison in Texas which they've taken over. They have one in Iowa, and I believe that they are about to get one in Florida.
Right.
This is strictly for evangelical or born again Christians. Now, you know, I take the position that their work is valuable and is good. It's very intensive. As well as the religious aspects of their work, they also try to build people's skills. They also provide mentors for people when they are released from the system. So it's no wonder that they do, there has been one study which suggests that there is a definite decline in recidivism as a result of this kind of intensive program. My argument is we ought to be doing this for everybody.
Right.
Not everybody in the prison system is a born-again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody in the prison system is going to be a born-again Christian. So I'm all in favor of letting them carry on their valuable work, but I say we should extend the program to other people as well, other people who may not be Christian, who may not be born again, or who may not have the appetite for this particular style of evangelical treatment, if you will.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I discussed this with my father quite a bit, and he took the position that the Bible was somehow a central plank of this, and it wouldn't work without it. But I would lean more towards your view as well.
Well, if you have people who are willing to give it a shot, and if you help them acquire some kind of job skills, and if you give them a mentor to lean on and some kind of social network to rely on when they get out of prison, then they're definitely going to have a better chance of not returning. I think that's just pure common sense. Unfortunately, what we've done in this country is that we've basically stripped away most of the rehabilitative services that were provided to a bare minimum. At first, it was done to make prison more unpleasant for people, to be tougher on these people. Then it was done because we can't afford to provide the programs anymore because the system became so large and the state budgets became so stretched, especially after 2000 when the economy nosedived. So what can you cut in the prison system? You can't cut on the security. You can't cut on salaries. You can't cut on health care, although they are trying to do that with disastrous results. So they cut on programs, and that's what's happened. Now, you know, majority of prisons offer no programs. That means we're just warehousing people until they finish their sentence, and then they get out.
Mm. And I was wondering, if I could ask just another question, is there a country that you know about? Is there some other place that you've studied, some other country that you've studied, where you feel like they're really doing a good job with prisons? Is there an alternative that you've seen working?
You know, I'm not an expert on other countries. I've never actually been in a prison in another country. So, but I will say this: in Europe, the incarceration rate is 6 to 10 times lower as a proportion of the population than it is in the United States. So, certainly, the system is not as bloated as it is here, and it doesn't scoop up as many people for seemingly, you know, trivial offenses as we do here.
Mm. All right, well, thank you very much. I'll keep listening.
Just real quick to pick up on the point you made about the fact that in so many places, any kind of programming that we might put under the heading of rehabilitation has been, a lot of that has been cut back in part for financial reasons. I wonder to what extent you think contributing to that is the fact that as an idea, it seems that we've gotten away from the very idea of rehabilitation. We've given up on the idea that adult criminals can be changed, and we still seem to be holding on to that idea a little bit when it comes to juveniles. But even there, I think that we're backing away from the idea that even a child can't be rehabilitated.
Dave, I think what you say is true for much of the 80s and 90s. There was this attitude that what we have to do is basically throw them in and throw away the key, let them rot. Whatever happens to them in there, they got it coming to them. But now we have a situation where a lot of the people who were sent away in the mid-80s for 15 years or in the 90s for 10 to 15 years, they're getting out. And so we have a reentry now of about 650,000 people a year leaving prisons and coming back to their communities. And, of course, they're entirely unrehabilitated. So now the new buzzword is reentry. Everyone's talking reentry. Even President Bush spoke about it in his State of the Union address, where he spoke about helping people who are leaving the prison system. My contention, of course, is but by the time they leave the system, it's too late. You have to do something with them while they're in there. You have to somehow make a change. It's tough to get a job if you're a felon. I mean, it can be tough to get a job even if you're not a felon in the economy we've got now. But if you're a felon, many employers are not going to employ you. You lose all kinds of rights if you've been in prison. You lose the right, for instance, of federal housing grants or for federal Pell grants to get a college education. You lose the right to join a whole number of professions. You lose the right in many states to vote, and you lose that for life. And what I say in Gates of Injustice is that justice demands that when the punishment has been served, the punishment is over. And what we do in the United States right now is we keep on punishing people for the rest of their lives. And that is just, that to me, is un-American. I, as you hear from my accent, grew up in Britain like your last caller, became an American in early 1997. It was a proud moment in my life. I really believe in the U.S. Constitution and U.S. values. Unfortunately, we're not taken seriously in many parts of the world anymore. Look at the problems that President Bush has convincing public opinion in other countries, and these are countries that really loved America when I was growing up and looked to America. And now, you know, we're seen as the bad guys. It just pains me awfully to see that. And, you know, our domestic disgrace, which I think our prison system is, has become part of our foreign policy problem.
Next caller is in Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. As long as there's only a moment left, I guess I'll just go to this point. I guess last night on the BBC, some segments of a Texas training video, prison training video, were shown where humiliation is sort of regularized and routinized. The people are made to lay on, crawl on the ground and strip while they're crawling and spread and all that sort of stuff. I saw it first on a website called pottv.net, where you can watch it with a sort of a real libertarian, you know, anti-drug crime sort of rap. But the point is that, and it, PotTV, and it's about Abu Ghraib, because they're saying, you know, this is going on here. It's said, and even one of the prisoners, or one of the guards, came out of the Philadelphia prison system. But the idea that it can be routinized and trained, I mean, one always sort of knew that these abuses were going on, but they have the apparent, you know, audaciousness to show it and put it in a training video. It's quite astonishing stuff. So I suggest people go to that, or if they want to get it from the BBC, I think it was shown in last night's, and if people are good on the net, they can find that video. It's just, well, to me, it's just amazing that you know, that it could be routinized as that and taught.
You know, I'm familiar with that video, and I describe the incident in my book. It happened in Brazoria County, I believe, in 1997. A group of inmates from Missouri, where there was overcrowding, were sent down to Texas, Brazoria County, Texas. And just as you described, they were made to strip, they were attacked by guard dogs, they were made to crawl along the ground. Now, that is, and it was videotaped. Now, that isn't regularized. That incident was very much an aberration. I think there was a civil lawsuit. The county had to pay a couple of million dollars in compensation to the inmates, or they settled it for a couple of million. So it's not used to train correctional staff in any
way. I'm happy to hear that, actually.
And you know, I think that most correction officers are decent people who just want to get through the day and go home uninjured, unhurt. It's a minority who are, just as in Iraq, you know, you don't want to say that all the U.S. troops in Iraq, far from it, involved in abuse. It's a minority. But, of course, the minority can do enormous damage, as, again, we've seen in Iraq. That is not a video that's used to train correctional officers.
I'm glad to be corrected, but I think there also is... we know that, as you mentioned earlier, rape is done systematically, that where they put people in with known offenders. So maybe it's not done, you know, in a systematized and bureaucratized way, which is good. But it is habitual and done, and also,
you know, I would definitely agree with you on that. And I think that it's well known that rape is used as a management tool in some prisons by some prison authorities. They allow the most aggressive, most dangerous inmates to kind of let off their sexual energy and steam by victimizing and raping weaker, vulnerable inmates, and that keeps the facility peaceful, so to speak. It's also a major problem when people are raped, they have no one to turn to. If they go to the authorities to complain, they could be labeled as a snitch, and the consequences of that can be fatal. And oftentimes, if they do pluck up the courage to complain and they go to the authorities just laugh in their faces. I cite the case of a guy called Roderick Johnson in Texas, who was turned into a sex slave. Rival gangs were actually in a bidding war for his services, and they were trading them back and forth. Now, when he went to the authorities repeatedly, many times, and they just told him to get himself a boyfriend who could defend him. So, you know, with that kind of attitude, we have a serious problem.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's go on here next. We'll have a caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. Could you tell me the expense of the Partnership for Drug-Free America ads that we all...
I'm sorry, I don't know that.
Oh, uh-huh. They just seem so wasteful and ineffective. I'm sure you've seen them, but they just seem just a total waste of hard-earned taxpayer dollars, but you don't have any...
I don't know how much they cost, and I don't know how effective they are.
Okay, that's all I had. Thank you.
All right. We will go on again to Bloomington, Indiana, line four. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned Chuck Colson's prison fellowship program.
I did, yes, indeed.
You mentioned that there's a research study showing that the program, the prison fellowship program works, and the figures on that study are that it reduces recidivism, that is to say, people don't return to prison after they're released, only about a quarter, it reduces about by just about three quarters. The control group in that study was simply a control group of average prisoners that were released, and in that control group, 20% repeated, came back to prison. But in the prison fellowship group, only 6% repeated. So,
I've seen a study. I think it was done by the University of Pennsylvania. I think you have to run the study for a few more years, though. You know, it may be that those figures are very low, and it may be that was just recidivism after a year. I think you have to run it for 2-3 years. But I do believe that Chuck Colson's methods can reduce recidivism, and I think that reducing recidivism has a huge financial payoff. It costs California, and I take that as a fairly average state, $34,000 to keep an inmate in prison for a year. So if you can keep 100 of them out, that's already $3.4 million. If you keep 1,000 of them out, $34 million. Keep doing the math. You know, the figures add up pretty damn quickly.
Yes, that's very true, but you made an objection that I should like to answer. You objected that you said that these people in this prison fellowship program should not be required to be born again.
No, I didn't say that.
Oh,
what
didn't.
I said was that we should have programs for other people who are not born again.
Oh, okay.
I have no objection to Mr. Colson's evangelical program in the prison system. I think it's a good thing. I support it. All that I'm saying is we should try and offer some of these same services to people who may not feel able to be born again Christians. You know, there are other people in our prison system who are not Christian. There are people who are Muslim. There are people who are Jewish. There are people who have no religion whatsoever. And there are other Christians, you know, who belong to sects that don't follow the particular guidelines of Mr. Colson. And these people are also deserving of these services. That's my only argument.
I see. Well, you know, a Christian would say to you, Jesus is the only way. And when President Bush, during the last presidential campaign, he was asked, who is your favorite philosopher? And he said it was Christ, because he changed my heart. Do you remember that quote?
Yes, I certainly do remember that quote. But you know what? I think that if you were to argue to me that Jesus is the only way to gain eternal life, I'll say, let's wait and see. You know, you may be right, you may be wrong, time will tell.
Right.
But if you're talking about life on earth, as we know it, in the United States, we should be offering services to everybody, not just to people who belong to or join a particular sect or a particular ideology.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much.
All right, and other questions, again, are certainly welcome. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Alan Elsner. He is a national correspondent for Reuters News Agency and author of the book Gates of Injustice, about the crisis in America's prison. Something that maybe we just touched on a little bit, and I want to come back to, is the issue of how many people are sick, are physically sick in prison. We talked about mental illness. We talked about substance abuse. We do have also a significant problem with infectious disease, sexually transmitted diseases.
Right.
Like,
I have a whole chapter on this, right, which is obviously difficult to encapsulate in a very short time. But,
right.
But there's no question that illness and disease spreads very easily through prison systems. They're unventilated places. People are held in very close quarters. There was one study that showed that about 560,000 people who are active, who are carriers of tuberculosis, were being released from our prisons and jails every year. We believe that about 40% of the inmates of our prisons have hepatitis C. AIDS, they've done a fairly good job on treating, and they've really cut down the death rate from AIDS, because I think, you know, it's very, very expensive to allow a prisoner to proceed to full-blown AIDS. It's much cheaper to keep them on a drug regimen. But there are all kinds of outbreaks, Legionnaire's disease, sexually transmitted diseases. There was an article in the New York Times on Sunday that looked at the Los Angeles County Jail, which is in crisis. They've had 5 murders of inmates there in the last 7 months. But it also mentioned the fact that prisoners were sitting there with staph disease, or I guess that's a bacterial infection, which was spreading unchecked through the population. And another problem is that, you know, when people are put on antibiotics to treat this condition,
the prisons often make it very difficult for them to keep their, taking their drugs. And if they don't finish the course of antibiotics, what we're contributing to is the emergence of drug-resistant bacteria, which is a serious problem which is happening in our prison system as well.
We'll see if we can go real quick and get one more caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes. Hi. I'll try to make this quick. When you were talking about California earlier in the program and the strength of the union out there for correction workers, it made me wonder how dangerous is it to work in a prison? Because I know here in Illinois, just recently, the pension program for correction workers was beefed up because they claim it's quite dangerous. So if you have any information about that, I appreciate it.
It is quite dangerous. My book does contain the figures on the number of inmate assaults on prison correctional officers, and there have been deaths as well, although they've cut down on some of those. It's also an extremely stressful kind of a job, and there have been studies that show that divorce rate is particularly high, that some of these people also have psychological programs, but there's a kind of macho code which prevents them from asking for help. So the corrections officer's life is not an easy one, and I believe that the crisis that we have in our prison system makes it more difficult than it need be.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right. Just to finish up, I guess we're still dealing with the public. It seems to me that we're still dealing with the public attitude to justice issues and to security that it seems that people who are running for office like to play on. Going back to your earlier comments about how no politician wants to seem to be soft on crime, you can always appeal to people on that sort of basis. Do you think that that's likely to change, the public attitude, I mean?
Well, I think that the best hope for that changing is the escalating costs. At some point, people are going to realize that every dollar they spend on their prisons is a dollar that they're not spending on their schools or on their health care or on their social services or their infrastructure. $57 billion is a lot of money, and you know, next year they'll do another study and it'll be $65 billion. At some point, people are going to say, hey, you know, this is crazy. We can't go on doing this. That's what my belief is, and I'm trying to educate people through this book as to the facts of the system so that we can at least start a debate. And I think, you know, this program, thank you very much for having me, because it's enabled me to get my message across to your listeners and perhaps provoke some debate there.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time.
It's been absolutely my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Our guest, Alan Elsner. He is national correspondent for Reuters News Agency. His book is titled Gates of Injustice, The Crisis in America's Prisons. Prentice Hall is the publisher on the book. The broadcast today is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from Europe, the Middle East, India, and around the world. Food tastings held every Saturday from 11 to 5. World Harvest Foods at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Tomorrow morning on the program at 10 o'clock, we'll talk with Locke Johnson from the University of Georgia about strategic intelligence. Hour 2, the guest is David Bacon, associate editor at Pacific News Service. We'll be discussing his book, The Children of NAFTA, Labor Wars on the U.S.-Mexico Border. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your calls. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned, because up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Today, following the 1 o'clock news, we'll talk with legal scholar Derek Bell. His latest book is Silent.